You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. I don't actually know how to start. This is one of those days where you just go, there's just so much. I guess you start off with the image of Donald Trump, the old curmudgeon on the lawn, screaming, "It's over! Get off my lawn! Go home!" Because evidently what he took from Gordon Sondland's testimony today is no quid pro quo. I guess this is that no collusion, no obstruction, no collusion. This is no collusion. This is that. This is him trying to convince himself that it's going to be okay. It's not. In fact, this was a weird moment because this is like one of the first times Trump has come out on the lawn, screamed some stuff, and then disappeared. Didn't engage with anybody, didn't answer questions, none of that. Just, it's over. Get off my lawn. He read this statement and had the note evidently somebody wrote for him in big Sharpie. Which, no quid pro quo, no quid pro quo, no quid pro quo. and I'll tell you, I'll be honest. I think Gordon Sondland, who I expected to cover his behind. I expected him to come and bare his soul. I know I had some people say, no, he's going to be a good trooper. No, the more I learned about Sondland, the more he's a wannabe player. He's willing to give money to a bunch of different Republicans and Democrats. He was looking for a job, man. He was looking for the title. He was looking to do some fun stuff, the pomp and circumstances, the parties, that stuff. That's what he wanted. And they actually gave him a real gig, which is, I get the patronage appointments. I get that because it's always going to happen. It's always been. But you don't put the patronage appointment in a real gig. You give them something cushy, not something like Ukraine. Just kind of throwing that out there. But I'll tell you, Gordo's got to be exhausted today after a day of throwing people under the buses and then dusting them off and throwing them back under the bus again. Because, look, he threw Trump under the bus because he said, yes, there was a quid pro quo. Threw Rudy under the bus. Everybody threw Giuliani under the bus, threw Mick Mulvaney under the bus, threw Rudy Giuliani under the bus, threw Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, under the bus, threw Rudy Giuliani under the bus, threw Mike Pence under the bus, got Pence involved in this. He threw Rudy Giuliani under the bus. Did I mention he threw Rudy Giuliani under the bus? He threw Rudy under the bus, threw Rick Perry under the bus, one of the three amigos, threw him under the bus, and of course, he threw Rudy Giuliani under the bus. Did I mention Rudy? Because, again, all roads seem to lead back to Rudy, and as I'm sitting here watching the testimony, I'm going, Democrats, you've got to subpoena him. You've got to put Rudy in that seat. And I think that would be a pay-per-view moment. I think we should do pay-per-view for that because there's no way Giuliani could keep his cool. There's just no way. And here's the thing. He doesn't have presidential immunity. He doesn't work for the administration. He is a private lawyer. I think susceptible to being subpoenaed. Now, a lot of these guys, if it's you or me or any folks like us, Congress gives you a subpoena, you better get your butt there and you better be there with bells and whistles and early. With your Sunday best, and bring something, a dish, a bottle of wine, something. But I guess a lot of these guys feel, subpoena, don't have to listen to that. I think you could get him in that seat. Because look, everybody's tying him to all of this stuff because he's Trump's guy. When Sondland says, talk to Rudy. That's the president going, This is who I've designated for you to deal with to fulfill my wishes. And it was incredibly amazing. And here's the strange thing. The Democrats still had their debate this evening. The debate is still going on. I said, and I thought this from the beginning, they should have just canceled the debate. There should have been no debate tonight. In fact, all they should have done is replayed Gordon Sondland's testimony over and over and over again. Because I don't run out of enjoyment watching Sondland throw, you know, Trump and Rudy and Pompeo and Perry and Mulvaney and the rest of them under the proverbial bus. I have no problem with that. But I think the Sondland's testimony should have been played over and over again. Because guess what? Nobody's really paying attention to the Democratic debate. This completely overshadowed it. And in fact, this completely overshadowed the testimony of the other two people who testified, Laura Cooper and the guy who I can't remember his name. That's how big Sondland's testimony was. And if I thought, you know, Vindman's testimony was solid yesterday, this was, I hope the Republicans on the dais wore their Depends, because they had to be doing something. Because he came out and he just let it go. And maybe they had to, too. Because there was nothing good in this for them. If you thought the two Republican guests from yesterday were bad, and they were bad, Sondland just crushed them. Because understand, the Republicans' defense in all of this has been fairly simple. There was no quid pro quo. What's the first thing that Gordon Sondland said? Yep, quid pro quo. Yep, that was fully apparent to him. They said, you know, you're just hearing these witnesses who had no firsthand account of any of this. Nobody on the phone calls. There's nobody except for yesterday. You had two people on the call. And now you've got Gordon Sondland, who was involved in all of one of the three amigos, one of Trump's three amigos, saying that, yeah, there was quid pro quo. Another defense was, well, the Ukrainians didn't know. They didn't know that we were holding back the money. So, you know, they couldn't have been pressured because they didn't know the money wasn't already on the way. That got crushed today as well. Sondland crushed that. And so did Laura Cooper, who pointed out that she got an email that day. There were emails that day from the Ukrainians going, is there a problem? Yeah, there's a problem. We're literally strong-arming it. Then they argued, well, you know, Trump wasn't really involved. He was really concerned about corruption. Except when you look again at the phone calls and the stuff that they've released, he doesn't mention corruption. He mentions Burisma. He mentions Hunter Biden. He doesn't mention corruption. So this argument, well, you know, it was only about corruption. Nonsense. And even Sondland goes, well, you know, you kind of got to put that together. I mean, there was so much there. And oh, by the way, you know, the as were yesterday, Here Right Matters was the bumper sticker out of yesterday's Vindman testimony, and which I think is a great frame. Today's bumper sticker, everyone knew. Evidently, according to Sondland, everyone knew. Which again, you know, goes against one of the defenses that they claim nobody knew. You know, how is it a quid pro quo if nobody knows? Now you've got Sondland going, no, everybody knew. We all got it. We're not idiots. So, look, I watched Devin Nunes. I watched the Republicans today dance and try and attack Schiff and the media and the process. Didn't go well. Didn't go well at all. So, for me, the whole thing, you know, came down to one like 5 second soundbite, and it was Congressman Maloney who had asked Sondland who would benefit from the Ukrainians investigating the Bidens, and Sondland was I assume Donald Trump. You assume, yeah, that was pretty easy. Maloney said, "This is the heart of it. Who benefits by bringing up Burisma? Who benefits by bringing this company up?" Now, again, I'm not defending Hunter Biden. I think it was slimy. I think all of this patronage stuff is slimy. I think it should be illegal. It's not. It's unethical. It's immoral. But again, you go back to yesterday's testimony with the Republican. They wanted Kurt Volker. They wanted Ambassador Volker, who came right out and said, look, you know, investigating the company for corruption, you know, seems maybe plausible. But investigating Joe Biden, ridiculous. And again, crushes the whole reason that Trump actually wanted it. So again, you know, this is one of those days where you just go, there was so much. There was so much to get to, so much that I think I'm still trying to digest all. I'm still trying to wrap my head around now who's all involved. Because according to Sondland, they all knew, man. Even pulled Mike Pence into this. And they've been, you know, the Republicans have been doing their best to keep Pence out of this because they might need a backup president. If both of them get impeached, you got Nancy Pelosi. And that, again, that's one of the arguments that the Republicans are saying, well, that's why Nancy Pelosi's really, really pushing for impeachment. Understand, Nancy Pelosi wanted no part of impeachment. I still think impeachment, if it doesn't go well, could help Trump. Because it could, at the other end of this, allow him to say to his base, I took on those Democrats and I won because they didn't. I've been exonerated. No, you just weren't convicted. In a rigged game, you weren't convicted. Doesn't mean you're not guilty. And if you look at this, I can't imagine that the American people tonight aren't watching their news and reading the newspaper tomorrow and seeing what Sondland testified to. It is really incredible. And then, like I said, you had this Laura Cooper, one of this Defense Department official, who, you know, surprise, there were these emails. And they knew. I just thought it was incredible. I mean, she revealed that, you know, these they knew about it. They knew the day of the call. And evidently the day before Sondland and Volker met with Zelensky. So this is one of those things where now you start putting all the pieces together. And the Ukrainian president's not stupid. But he is in a position where he's screwed. Because he needs that aid. That money doesn't come. He doesn't get those weapons. And the Russians just come in and wipe him out. In fact, I was reading through Laura Cooper's testimony. And this is, I didn't know that, you know, 14,000 Ukrainians have died in this war with Russia. You know, a lot of us don't think that, you know, that it's still an ongoing hot war. You know, I was talking to somebody who said, well, they just took over Crimea and it's all over now. No, they took over Crimea, yeah. But they're still pushing forward. So you've got this president who's now just coming into office. You've got all this corruption, all this chaos. And not to mention, you've got the Russians coming to take your country away. So you're turning to the one ally that can really help you, the U.S., and what do? They strong-arm you. It's just incredible to me. I mean, so much corruption, so much graft, so much hypocrisy. Perfect example. Evidently, Nikki Haley, the story broke today. Evidently, Nikki Haley, the former U.N. ambassador, evidently lost her password to the secured communication system, so decided to not use it. And evidently had done some back and forth with classified information on a different, less secure system that somebody remembered the password. So, I mean, her argument is, well, you know, Hillary Clinton used a private email server. I just forgot my password. How's that different? Still classified information going over unsecure systems. So if I'm counting right, the people who, you know, brought us lock her up for possibly mishandling classified documents because of her private email server. Those people who wanted her locked up for that, I'm looking at it. I'm going, well, Jared evidently was using WhatsApp to text and private email. Ivanka's using private email. Steve Bannon, when he was there, was accused of using private email. Rince Priebus, while he was there, evidently was using private email. Stephen Miller has been accused of using private email. Hope Hicks, who actually got hacked, was not using the proper email. And now Nikki Haley. So if I'm counting, that's like seven. So how many of these people are going to go to jail? When do we start locking them up? Just kind of questioning. Kind of makes you wonder. But today, not a good day. Not a good day for Donald Trump at all. Even though, like I said, he was out on the lawn early. doing the curmudgeon thing. Get off my lawn. It's over. It's over. No, no quid pro quo. And I love the fact that here's the part that gets me. And this is where I'm really stuck. And maybe you'll have a thought on this where I don't. The conversation that he had with Sondland, according to Sondland and repeated by Donald Trump, goes like this. You know, what the blank do you want? Sondland asking President, what the blank do you want in Ukraine? And Trump responding, I don't want a quid pro quo. I don't want anything. I don't want anything. I don't want a quid pro quo. And I'm going, wait a second. There is no way in a cold day that Donald Trump, with his third grade vocabulary, comes up with quid pro quo. There's just no way possible. And, you know, there's just not. There's, unless somebody whispered it in his ear. There's just no way. You know, this is kind of one of those moments where you go, you know, hey, you remember that didn't happen, right? You remember, yeah? Knowing full well that you both remember what happened. To me, that's one of those moments. So lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, our good friend Red T. Raccoon is going to be here to share some thoughts on the testimony thus far. Right back after this. Nothing more American than workers standing up. And the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1896. That was the day anarchist and labor activist Rose Posada was born. Her name, Raquel Piasotti, was changed like so many others at Ellis Island. She had fled Tsarist Russia in 1913 as a teenager and soon found work in New York City's garment shops. She readily joined the ILGWU, becoming a national organizer by 1920. In the late 1920s, Rose went to Los Angeles in an attempt to organize Latina sweatshop workers. There, she helped women workers establish a bilingual labor journal and assisted them in winning a key strike for recognition and higher wages in 1933. She soon ascended to the position of union vice president and worked closely with the newly formed CIO. Rose traveled far and wide to organize garment workers. She led successful strikes throughout the United States and in Montreal and Puerto Rico. By 1936, she was on the picket lines with striking rubber workers in Akron, Ohio, and auto workers in Flint, Michigan. She increasingly found herself at odds with ILGWU head Dave Dubinsky and other top male union officials over persistent sexism, her radical politics, and her opposition to the no-strike pledge during World War II. Rose resented the fact that though women comprised the overwhelming majority of the union's membership, she continued to be the only woman union officer. Frustrated by the chauvinism she experienced, Rose resigned from her post as vice president and later from the ILGWU executive board in 1944. She continued as a sewing machine operator, remained active at the local level, and published two memoirs. Later in life, she aligned herself with the civil rights movement. Rose Posada died of cancer in 1965. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So David Pressman, the attorney for Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, evidently has sent a letter to Fox News telling them that they need to retract or correct a segment that was done by reportedly Laura Ingraham, and also, I guess, things that have been said by Dumb Jr. and Tucker Carlson about Vindman, you know, possibly being guilty of espionage. And again, this plays into the attack frame of Alexander Vindman, questioning his patriotism, questioning his loyalty. It's really slimy. It's horrible, but it's not surprising because that's who these people are. I mean, the fact that you had a guy questioning why he wore his uniform, I'm just mind-blowing. And here to share some thoughts on the impeachment hearings thus far and also the treatment of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, I've asked our good friend Red T. Raccoon to come talk with us, popular Twitter commentator, disabled veteran, and advocate. Red, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me. I'm wearing my uniform right now. Is that okay?
Perfectly fine by me. You earned it.
Exactly. It the ridiculousness that they duped down to yesterday is just unbelievable. But, you know, every time we got on this phone call, you know, we're not surprised. It's, you know, I knew it was going to happen. And actually, I'm glad he showed up in that uniform because they need to see that. That's a real hero right there that is fighting for our democracy.
Yep.
Off the battlefield in a hearing. And it's, you know, it's, there's a lot of bravery that's involved with that, too.
No, because, I mean, certainly. I mean, the first thing we saw yesterday was the Wall Street Journal broke the story that the Army is making contingent plans to keep him and his family safe. I mean, yeah. You know, and while he's, you know, reassuring his father he's going to be okay, that, you know, he's not going to be disappeared or pushed out a window, the Army's actually trying to figure out how to make sure that doesn't happen.
I know. And this is a serious soldier. I mean, this, it's funny, you know, people look at ribbons and awards and everything like that. One of the ones that I know he's probably most proud of is the combat infantry badge. This guy has seen warfare. Like, he was in a fight. You know, he was hit with an IED. He actually, you know, that story was told during the hearing.
Right.
This is not a pencil pusher. This is someone who has actually a very bright career, too. He's only 44 years old. And despite what people say, lieutenant colonels are not something that's common in the Army. You know, you don't see them just walking down the street randomly. This is someone that has, you know, or, you know, hopefully still has a bright future in the military.
No, and that's what I was going to ask you next, because, look, this has got to be, this had to play into his mind. You said he's got a bright future. I said the same thing. By coming out and, you know, exposing the commander in chief, this can't look good on the resume if it's found out.
You know, it's a tough decision, and that's, you know, where bravery comes in. Are you going to go and do the right thing when it's most difficult to go and do that? And that's one of the Army values, and he's showing it perfectly.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's real easy to make the right choice when there's no consequences involved with it. It's, you know, real integrity, kind of like real courage, is doing it when you know that there's very serious consequences that can follow as far as what you do, as far as doing the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, because it could have been easy to overlook this. It really could have.
Yeah, and that's why I believe the witnesses that I've seen so far is that you could have had every opportunity, not even just to look the other way. You could have taken advantage of a lot of these situations. And instead of doing that, they did the most difficult thing, and that's blow the whistle, and then actually go and kind of raise their hands and say, hey, something's seriously wrong here. And they've all kind of were doing it in their own separate ways. And it's interesting, too, it's just, you know, how the Republicans love going after process. You know, it's either they did it in the wrong chain of command. You know, what happened is they were talking to lawyers because, you know, you obviously see something that is going on that's wrong. And that's what they used to always tell us in the military also is, you know, if worse comes to worse, tell a lawyer. But it's just an amazing sequence of events. Like the past 2 days, is just insane.
In fact, you know, today I'm literally going, you know, Trump's right. It's over, and it's over for him because none of this looks good. Even the Republican witnesses, you know, Volker and Morrison, still said, you know, this wasn't right. This was irregular. There was still stuff there that even the ones who were supposed to be there to defend Trump weren't really there.
Now, and you're seeing these defenses just go down constantly as each day progresses. Great job by the Democrats. I know there's always kind of constant debate about how they go and schedule these hearings and how they had the people lined up, but they built a really good foundation right off the bat.
Yep. You build your case, you lay
exactly.
The foundation. And I thought they did that on day one. I thought they did a really good job. They brought Vindman in to then, you know, give some explosive stuff, firsthand testimony. And now this thing with Sondland today just blows it open. Cause you know, their defense is gone.
Yeah, exactly. And you mentioned it before, it plays well to the general public. And so I hate when people, you know, talk about the flashiness or, you know, have pizzazz, you know, but what I'm really looking for is, do you have sound bites that you can put on the evening news that everybody watches? So like, you know, like the ABC, CBS.
Everybody knew.
Exactly.
Everyone knew.
They caught those. I mean, it was just as straightforward as it comes. Yes, there was quid pro quo. You know, it's and the American public can go and digest that and understand exactly what's going on. And everyone knows this is not some crazy scam that they're pulling. It's obvious that the Ukraine had no choice in this matter.
Yep.
Like, you're right. They were backed into a corner completely. You have a brand new president who has Putin breathing down his neck. Like, literally, and you're right. Like, it's sad how our domestic politics have blinded us as far as some of the foreign issues over the past 3 years. And that's another kind of, we're going to look back at Trump as far as that's one of the most kind of interesting things that we've kind of missed. But the Russian-Ukraine war right now is a real war. This isn't something that, you know, we kind of think of these kind of like small conflicts because we've been stuck in Afghanistan or Iraq for so long. We don't realize that there are real conflicts going on right now.
And yeah, when I read 14,000 people, 14,000 people have died in this so far. That's no little conflict.
No, not at all. And that's, you know, what's being reported and what's being found. They're probably finding mass graves all over the place. And the interesting thing, too, about it as far as global politics is concerned is it doesn't stop with the Ukraine. Georgia is having the same problem right now with Russia, and they're trying to go and annex part of that country right now. Also, same situation with the new president. The global theater, we used to, like, unfortunately, I mean, I'm a little bit too young to realize, you know, how much of an impact it was during, like, the Vietnam era, but, like, there's proxy wars going on, and there's land grabs. There's a lot going on the global scale that we just haven't been paying attention to.
And we've got a guy in the White House who isn't interested in it at all. I mean,
exactly.
And that's my problem with this. You put people into these positions who, like Sondland. Look, I'm thrilled he came and he told the truth to keep his butt out of jail. He's no hero in my view. He's clearly a guy who said, you know what? I'm not going to get tied up in a lifetime of legal battles. I'm telling the truth. I'm going to be done with it. I'm not going to jail. And for that, he should be given credit. But this was a guy who was a lightweight. He had no business in that job whatsoever.
No, none. And then what you're seeing, and it's interesting because, you know, they talk about two different groups, you know, the shadow group. It's because you have the lifelong public servants that were kind of grouping together. And it seems like, and it's going to be interesting kind of looking back in history too, is how many times this happened in other departments.
Right.
It's like they were circling the wagons around themselves and saying, hey, let's try to hold on to any sanity that we can. Let's try to keep the situation as normal as possible. You know, as far as what traditional American policy is concerned. And then you have the group of people that have no experience whatsoever and are basically just following the orders of Trump doing completely separate things.
Yeah. And then, no, I look at Vindman, and Vindman's, again, I go back to his testimony. He's the guy who understands that region. And to his credit, he understood what withholding that aid meant. He understood, you know, any wavering from support for Ukraine could turn that country into a political football, and it still may have already happened. I mean, Ukraine may be lost because of what's going on right now, because the Republicans may turn their back on them.
No, it's completely true, and it's sad that it's happening so early in a new presidency in the Ukraine, and again, it's just going to empower Putin even further. Like, and all this is a win for him throughout this whole entire thing, even if it just causes mass chaos in the United States itself. Yeah. It's a win. But I think actually there was an article that came out today. He said that he's glad that it's taking the attention off of Russia right now because he's having some serious problems internally. He's not going to be able to go and maintain the situation in Ukraine unless something gives. And fortunately, Trump fell in his lap and something is giving right now. What if he never got caught? It was coming down to the wire as far as those funds were concerned. And who knows what else has happened outside of our view. This could have happened in Asia. This could have happened in other countries. Who knows what's happening in South America right now?
Yeah, I keep saying the same thing. I mean, imagine what we know, and then imagine what we don't know and how bad it really is.
Yeah.
Well, you know, while we're watching the dumpster burn, you know, what are they doing with the wrecking balls behind our back?
Yeah, and apparently this was the perfect call. Like, please, I do not want to know what a disaster looks like. Because, you know, it happened at some point, and someone tried to sweep it up underneath the rug. And who knows, one of those grown-ups may have not been in the room.
Excellent point. Now, have you been watching the hearings? Because I've been particularly interested in Devin Nunes. Nunes has been an apologist for Trump the whole time. I've always said that there's got to be something on him for him to act the way he does. I mean, you know, he's literally the clown show. He's the court jester at this point. Now we find out that through Lev Parnas, his attorney, you know, Lev Parnas, the indicted associate of Rudy Giuliani, that evidently this lawyer is saying that Parnas arranged meetings and calls in Europe for Devin Nunes in 2018. So you start looking at this and you go, while all roads are leading to Rudy, Nunes is part of this as well.
Yeah, and, you know, we've always had that feeling about him the whole entire time. Like, there was the whole entire sideshow when he was, like, you know, sprinting to the White House to go and, you know, give information as far as the Russia investigation.
Yeah, the midnight pajama parties.
Exactly, yeah. There's where there's smoke, there's fire. And, man, he is smoking right now. There's something going on. And I think what's happening, too, is that, you know, at a certain point, if you're Devin Nunes, if you're somebody that might not have a squeaky clean background, you might have a couple skeletons in your closet, you don't want these hearings to continue. You don't want them to keep on digging and keep on going further and further, because eventually someone's going to open up the closet door and all those skeletons are going to start falling out.
Yeah.
And, you know, do you want to go to jail or do you want to go and lose your career over a reality TV star?
I think it's already too late for Nunes. I think he's in deep. There's no way out of this for him. So he's got to continue down this path. But what I find, you know, really just, you know, quite interesting on a bunch of levels is that I don't see any other Republicans, you know, defecting at this point. I mean, today there've got to be a bunch of people, you know, with the bottle sitting in front of them and staffers, you know, guarding the windows, because look, the Republicans have backed Trump all the way to this point and it ain't looking good.
Now, and you know, the House has been chirping a lot, but what it really comes down to is what's going to happen in the Senate. And it's been kind of eerily quiet over there. I would be interested to see people that maybe kind of have nothing to lose. So, like, Burr here in North Carolina is not going to run for re-election. He's not due up for another 2 years anyways. And he's on the Senate Intelligence Committee. It would be interesting to see if he can go and pull any people in a certain direction. I don't want to give the Republicans advice, but at a certain point, you either need to go all in with Trump or cut bait, because you're starting to get a little bit close to primary season.
See, I think they're all in. I think there's no way back for them at this point. They have
defended
all of these crimes for so long. They have covered it up. They have done everything they can do for him to this point. And I don't think they have a way back.
No, and I think so. Like, I always kind of, like, I used to play poker a lot. They're pot committed. You know, they've thrown in chips. They're looking down. There's more in the pot than there is in front of them. And so, you know, hey, what's the point? I'm going to go all in. You're right. It's shocking to me that this is, you know, the hill that they're going to die on.
Now, let's turn this back around for a second, because now I'm expecting the Republican argument to be, well, there was no direct order from Donald Trump. There, you know, there may have been a quid pro quo, but it wasn't at Trump's directive. It was Rudy Giuliani. It was all Giuliani's fault, because Donald Trump didn't tell Gordon Sondland, "I'm telling you to do a quid pro quo." And again, this is how simplistic they're going to try and make it. That like Donald Trump would actually, with his third grade vocabulary, be able to choose the word quid pro quo. Just throwing that out. I think their argument is going to be Donald Trump himself did not order the quid pro quo, so, you know, he's not guilty.
And so, like, I would, the simplest thing that I would say back to that is, so a private attorney is running our country right now. So Giuliani has no place in our government whatsoever. He's Donald Trump's attorney.
Right, but there'll be some who have said that we've sent, you know, private envoys to do all kinds of things throughout the years, and that's actually true.
Yeah.
So it's not wholly unusual. It's wholly unusual to have everybody answerable to Rudy, but it's not unusual to have somebody who's doing some things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be what they're going to go after, but it's just not going to fly. Like, there's too much, and just knowing Donald himself, that there was very few people that are actually in his organization before he became president. Like,
right.
As far as, like, upper management is concerned, I think it was, like, four. This isn't somebody that goes and relinquishes power. And again, he's not apparently not very good at covering up things either. It's been too much consistency among the witnesses that this was basically Trump's plan all along. Like it was, and you can see it too in some of the answering, like where they're like, you know, did he ever come out and actually say it? But it's like, no, hey, this is the overall theme. You know, and you know how he repeats himself too in very vague ways.
Right.
I'm sure those conversations are a complete disaster.
Oh, absolutely. But you know, so here's the thing. I blame Giuliani for all of this. My problem is I don't think Trump's smart enough to think strategically like this. So I think once Giuliani put it in his head, he got it and told Rudy to go on. Go. That's what we're going to do. Go after Burmese. Go after Hunter Biden, because we know that just the appearance that there's an investigation is going to harm Joe Biden, who, you know, was at that moment their biggest concern. I don't think they could have told that Biden was going to run a really crappy campaign to this point. But, you know, I think they were most concerned. I think they still are concerned about him, which is why I think, you know, Giuliani and all of the conspiracy hacks, you know, dreamt all this stuff up.
No, and I mean, and it kills a lot of birds with one stone. Again, you're pleasing your master when it comes to Putin. There's probably going to be people that are like involved with the reelection campaign that were going and scheming this up also. But yeah, my wife and I laugh about it all the time. It's going to be hilarious if he doesn't even, I don't think he's going to go that far where he's going to actually end up in the general election. I think something's going to happen before that. But
see, I see it differently. I see him walking out of this. I see the Republicans in the Senate standing firm. Maybe one breaks ranks, but I'm not expecting more. He's not convicted, and he walks out of it much like he did out of the Mueller report, you know, saying, you know, no quid pro quo, no obstruction, no collusion, and this will be no quid pro quo. I was exonerated, and the base will cheer, yay! They'll have rallies, they'll make it all look great, and he goes into the general having whipped the Democrats through this impeachment. Even though the game was rigged from the beginning and the Democrats did it because it was the right thing to do.
See, and like I might disagree with you on that one. So I think it would be the case if he didn't get walloped so bad in all of the governor races in Virginia. I think that's going to be in the back of everyone's mind down ballot.
Right, but I hope I'm wrong. Yeah. So I hope I'm wrong. I just don't think so.
Yeah, and we'll find out. And so, and here's the interesting thing too, is that we'll find out once the primaries start hitting what the turnout looks like at that point.
Right.
The turnout's already kind of being bigger and bigger. And so again, it'll be interesting to see what those candidates, the ones that are running for Senate, the ones that are running for all those House races, you know, all the local races, if they keep on feeling more and more pressure and they're afraid that, again, Trump is more of a liability than anything else, there might be a shift. And I can see it being very quick. It's going to be, you know, lightning fast. Once they get the votes, if it's going to be, you know, they're going to go and turn on him, I can see it being bam, bam. Just vote real quick. It's over. Get him out of there.
Do you really think 20 Republicans in the Senate are going to flip?
It depends on how clean Mike Pence is. And so, I mean,
and that was the other thing today. Pence was sucked into this as well.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think who else outside of that realm would you throw out as a candidate? That's, I think, the biggest concern that they have is going into 2020 is if they run into a situation where they don't really have a candidate, everybody down ballot's going to start losing. And so I'm thinking to myself, okay, the obvious situation is, you know, Mike Pence comes in and they go and keep running with him. If Mike Pence goes down with the ship, you need to find somebody really quick. And you need to go and find somebody that might, you know, figure out a way to be successful that's not challenged also in the primaries, because, again, primary season's coming up pretty quickly.
Yeah. My problem with that scenario is I think you could run a scarecrow and beat Mike Pence. I just think he's a horrible politician, has no charisma whatsoever. And I just I think he's extremely beatable.
Yeah.
Because he's crazy.
The revenge vote. Yeah. The revenge vote is what I would fear. Like, you know, the backlash. Hey, we're going to go and throw our support behind Pence because, you know, patron Saint Trump, you know, went down, you know, because of the Democrats. I mean, that would be my biggest fear about him, but you're right.
If 20 Republican senators flip, that means the temperature of the country is really hot, and I don't see a revenge vote then.
Yeah. I mean, see how it goes down.
This is why you play the game, and this is why this impeachment was so important. Because without these hearings, without these public hearings, we don't see Gordon Sondland say everybody knew there was a quid pro quo. You don't see Alexander Vindman in his dress blues saying that what I heard on that phone was wrong, and twice I went to my superior and reported this. You don't see those things without this impeachment hearing.
No, yeah, and that's why voting is so important. Like, 2018 was vitally important to what we're seeing right now, because we would just never even be having that conversation. So no matter what, definitely get out and vote, regardless of what happens. But again, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. Trump puts up this persona that, like, you know, he never quit. That's not the case with his history.
No.
Like, he has quit plenty of times in the past. The medical situation, too, I'm very curious about. I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but it was a random situation with him going to the hospital. And I wouldn't consider it out of the realm of possibilities where he starts pulling, what is it, at the end of, is it Casino? Where everyone goes into the courthouse, you know, in a wheelchair and on oxygen.
Yeah.
If Trump tries to go and pull that also. I mean, we've seen everything else from a mob movie, haven't we?
So what are we expecting tomorrow? Tomorrow you've got Fiona Hill and David Holmes set to testify. Are we expecting anything explosive there?
You know, I could have said that today, and then I would have been completely wrong. I think what it's going to be is a lot of, like, solidifying as far as the information is concerned and just kind of cross-referencing things. But who knows? it's interesting to see how, like, so much information has been kind of revealed, quote-unquote, over the past couple of days. Like, you know, they seem to be coming in with new information, kind of hot off the presses. But again, I don't know what can trump what we saw today.
Yeah,
pardon the pun there, but I was just jaw dropped, and you know, we got a little bit of a preview when the written came out before he actually said it, but just hearing it kind of come out of his mouth
was incredible.
Historic.
I mean, did it look to you like he was actually having fun?
It did.
I mean, really, I mean, it was one of these things like there's part of me that goes, look, because I view him as one of these guys, a rich guy who's, you know, just not happy being rich. He wants a legacy. And I got to tell you, this is a legacy for him. He's going to, this will go down in history. If all happens like you think it's going to, and he's actually ousted, this is going to be the guy who brought him down. History will remember Gordon Sondland's name.
Yeah. And I mean, you can kind of get that feeling, that smirk. I think it's probably the best way of saying it, that was on his face the whole entire time. People always want to have their names in the history book. And I mean, regardless of what happens, he's done it today.
Yeah.
And you're right. This is a story that's not very clean. Like, there's not, you have your heroes that come through, but you know, they're few and far between. Everyone was kind of involved with this at some point. And just, you know, everything Trump touches is kind of greasy to begin with, too. It's interesting. It's made for TV. I mean, and I hate to say it, we have our TV president. Why would this be any different?
There you go. I cannot wait for Fiona Hill and the other guy. I forgot his name already. To me, Fiona Hill is the one that I'm really most interested. David Holmes, he's going to be the guy who's testifying about the phone call, I guess, where Trump was screaming expletives into the phone. And I guess, again, we already knew that, you know, he was a foul mouth. This just kind of, you know, solidified that.
Exactly. Yep.
There you go. Good stuff. Red, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the thoughts. Look forward to talking to you again. And hey, good to have you back on Twitter.
Good to be back. Thank you. Anytime, Rick.
Good stuff. Appreciate it. Our good friend, Red T. Raccoon. Make sure you follow him on Twitter. One of my favorite commentators, especially on military issues. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith.
And this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1888. That was the day that William LeGrand Bundy is credited with inventing something that has become a daily part of life for millions of workers. His time recorder was a time clock that could record when workers arrived and left their jobs each day. The clock would record the time on a paper tape when a worker inserted his or her individualized numbered key. Bundy was a jeweler and an inventor from New York. After inventing his time clock, he went into business with his brother Harlow and founded the Bundy Manufacturing Company. With the growth of factories, there was more and more demand for time clocks. They were considered more exact and efficient than human timekeeping. Keeping track of hours worked and labor costs became an essential part of squeezing every drop of profit out of the industrial workforce. The Bundy brothers located their company in the city of Binghamton in southern New York. Business thrived. Other inventors put their own twist on the time clock. At the turn of the 20th century, the Bundy Company merged with several other timekeeping outfits, forming the International Time Recorder Company. Workers across the United States, Canada, and Europe had their work hours recorded by international time clocks. Later, the company became part of International Business Machines, or IBM, one of the worldwide leaders in workplace technologies. Over the years, new innovations have been introduced to employee timekeeping, such as time cards and computer-linked swipe cards. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So today is Transgender Day of Remembrance. This is an annual observance of remembering the transgender folks who have lost their lives in acts of anti-gender violence. So I thought it was an interesting day, this being the Day of Remembrance. I thought it would be fitting to highlight the fact that the one organization supposedly dedicated to transgender rights, the National Center for Transgender Equality, reportedly has had an NLRB charge filed against them for their mistreatment of their workers, which is why I've reached out to the Nonprofit Professional Employees Union and their vice president, Katie Burrows, to get some thoughts. Katie, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rick.
So walk me through what's going on. Obviously, today is a day of remembrance. Remembering workers' rights, I think, should be part of it. What's going on?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's kind of upsetting that on a day of remembrance, we're having a battle with the National Center for Transgender Equality Management for retaliating against their staff who were organizing a union with NPEU, the Nonprofit Professional Employees Union. And then also they retaliated for some other collective action. And so we filed an unfair labor practice on the staff's behalf.
So as I understand what happened is they fired, I guess, one person and then everybody else kind of collectively said this isn't right. Is this how I'm getting the story?
So what happened is the staff asked for voluntary recognition of their union back in November 2018. Which is their legal right to do. Yes. And they did this because they were hoping to fix some things that had been going on at the organization for a long time and work with management for their union on that. But management drug out the process. They never got recognized until a year later, which is classic union busting. But in this time, the work environment got more and more hostile. And it all came to a head when management fired a non-binary person of color. And it was apparently a very public firing, and the staff were very upset about this unjust firing, and they staged a walkout in response. And things weren't getting better, so the staff also wrote a letter asking management to resign. And that's when management basically drew a line in the sand and said, You can either, you can leave if you're unhappy with things. And so they pressured the rest of the staff who would have been in the bargaining unit out of the organization. They had one-on-one meetings, and they're basically like, they felt very pressured that they had to leave if they were involved with this collective action and union organizing activity.
Wow. I mean, that just sounds mind-blowing. I mean, you know, this is a community, and especially in this community that's, you know, oppressed and already marginalized and constantly abused, to have the management of an organization that's supposed to stop that. I guess it doesn't matter. I guess, you know, when management and when they've got the upper hand, they're going to abuse workers when they get the chance.
Yeah, I mean, the upsetting thing is management keeps, I mean, they keep saying that they're pro-labor and pro-union. And, I mean, clearly, if they can't recognize their staff union, they're not. But also, something a lot of our union contracts do is we explicitly protect the rights of transgender workers in the workplace. And then in a number of states, I think 27, so about half of the country, that there are no laws protecting transgender folks from discrimination. And so a union contract's really the only way to protect these folks. And the organization that fights for their equality, didn't see the value in having a union of their own organization.
That's mind-blowing. And, you know, it's one of the arguments that I make for people wanting and should want to have a contract, regardless of the situation. Having that contract protects your rights, even when state law or federal law doesn't. And to me, you know, that's one of the most important things. And I guess this is one of my problems with a lot of these organizations on the left. They have a lot of, you know, oh yeah, we're pro labor. Oh yeah, we're on that side. But when it comes to actually walking the walk, not so much.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, management is still management at progressive nonprofits. There are a lot of organizations that we have great relationships with management, and we collaborate, but we've seen lately with the National Center for Transgender Equality, and then we're seeing, it's not organizing with our union, but the Southern Poverty Law Center, management just really, fighting against their own workers who, you know, give so much to their organizations, are generally underpaid and overworked, and their staff doesn't want them or their management does not want their staff to have a union.
Now, isn't this one of those things where the people who support these organizations, isn't this kind of like a death knell? I mean, to be honest, you know, if I'm a supporter of that organization and they pull this, I pull my support.
A lot of times we, going to like the board and stuff, that's kind of a nuclear option. And so there is, trying to work it out, between, the employees and management is kind of the main strategy a lot of workers take, because they don't want to destroy the organization. These are missions that people
no, I get
easily
that.
Care
no,
about.
Sure, they care about it, but they're being destroyed. I mean, at some point, if you're carrying on the mission, you want the people who are helping you to know what's going on and to help forward the mission, which part of the mission, I would argue, is ensuring that transgender people have rights at work. I mean, this would be the one place, I think, that you would go, yeah, we're going to ensure that no matter where you work or what you do, you can't be fired for this. It just seems like the messaging is so perfect for right wing to just take on and go, look, they don't even want their people working for them.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing is, like, this is a really bad look for progressive organizations. And you know, it's upsetting to see, but we also have to hold them accountable. Like, if we're on the left preaching that workers have rights and that they deserve a fair return on their work, then we have to do that for our own employees at nonprofits, on local campaigns. So it's something that, like, I think finally, progressive nonprofit workers are saying, you know, we don't have to take this treatment anymore, right. And they're standing up for themselves.
No, because I know some people who've worked for nonprofits, and they couldn't wait to get away because they're working 90 hours a week for basically poverty wages. Because look, the organizations, you know, in a lot of cases, don't really have the resources. And look, the jobs have got to get done, and a lot of people do this because it is their passion. But it's turned into a model to where it's not, you know, it's no longer about your passion. It's about, you know, this is your job, and if you don't like it, you can leave. And for me as a union guy going, wait a second, the reason that you join and form unions is one, for better wages, hours, conditions, but also to have some say in how things are done, to have some voice on the job. To me, that's the key to this whole situation.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the organizations that our members work at, some have now board seats, and like the Democracy Collaborative just ratified their first contract, and they got an observer role on their board. So it is, you know, that is part of the reason they organize, is to get a say and to influence the work that's being done, and also the policies in the workplace.
Yeah, see, I would argue if you had an empowered workforce, you wouldn't need management. And you could take those resources that you're wasting on them and actually, do the mission. So let me ask you this. You guys have filed an LRB charge. With this administration, when I saw this, I'm going, with the Trump NLRB, this issue, do you worry this turns into a major political football?
No, I mean, we're just trying to seek justice for the workers, and we're also trying to hold management accountable. And this should be a wake up call to other nonprofits who might not be treating their employees as well as they should. That, you know, they can't get away with busting a union if their employees choose the form one.
Right. You know, this isn't a transgender issue. This is a workers issue.
Yes, and
I'm with you on that. So, you know, last line of questioning I've got for you, what can we do to help? Is there an action? I mean, because I think all of us want to ensure that, you know, people don't get fired for who they are. I think, in 2019, I think at some point you should have a right to be who you are and have rights on the job. What can we do?
Well, I think right now spreading the word, and also if you're a nonprofit employee, reaching out to MPU at mpu.org and exploring forming a union at your organization. Part of it is the more organizations that we organize, the more power we have to raise standards throughout the nonprofit sector,
right.
And to make sure that everyone gets compensated fairly, has a voice in the workplace, and it has all around better working conditions.
Yeah, I mean, the more of these nonprofits that are organized and have better wages, hours, conditions, and that stuff, the more the entire industry, because it is an industry, the more that it becomes the norm, I think.
Yeah, and like that's what I mean. We're kind of doing that in D.C. We currently have members at 14 D.C. nonprofits, and we're organizing a ton more. We get inquiries like almost every day from nonprofit employees who have the same problems that we've heard in the past, and we're like, we know how to help you fix them.
Yeah, and it's not just about left media or left nonprofits, or you'd organize, you know, the Heritage Foundation and those folks too, right?
Well, yeah, but they might not be in our local at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But if Heritage wants to reach out, we talk to them and tell them how to go about forming.
Well, like you said, at the end of it, I don't care where you work. It's about decent wages, it's about good benefits, and about the working conditions. And I don't think that's a right or left issue. I think it's just a worker issue. But, Katie, I appreciate the time. I wish you guys the best, and I'd love to hear how this turns out.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Good stuff. Thanks so much, Katie Burrows. She's the Vice President of Communications there at the Nonprofit Professional Employees Union. Quick break, right back. Stick around. Remember.